the opportunity to learn Shlishi of Parshas Noach, which is a fascinating aliyah filled with a lot of imagery. And some of the key themes in Parshas Noach are represented in this aliyah by itself. The aliyah begins by focusing on the mountains. They're telling us about how the flood had lasted for 40 days on the land. The water has now finally gotten strong enough to lift up the teva and to move it. And then the pasuk goes on to say, so now there's this emphasis on the fact the water is not only high, but that it covers up mountains. And the pasuk goes on to repeat the next pasuk, Chamesha Srei Amam Milamaila, Gavru Hamayim Viachusu Haharim. The water came very strong and it covered up the mountains. So what's this emphasis on the mountains? What's the whole point of telling us that the water covered up the mountains? There is an interesting discussion about this, focusing on the imagery of mountains. It can be found in the Sefer Shvilei Pinchas, or Pinchas Friedman, who we'll mention a couple of times today, has an interesting discussion about the significance of mountains here, and the fact that we find in Sefer Tehillim that the pasuk emphasizes Yerushalayim Harim Savivla, that Yerushalayim is surrounded by mountains, Hashem Saviv, and God is around that. So what's the imagery there? He notes that the Medrash here in Parshas Noach, the Medrash talks about the pasuk that says, pasuk in Tehillim, Lamed Vav, that God's tzedek, God's justice, is like these great mountains, and his mishpat, his judgment, is like the depths. So the Medrash comments that the depths of the world kind of threaten to overtake the world and to drown it out, except that the mountains are there to stop it. So what exactly is that imagery? What exactly is the message? So he suggests, what it seems to be, is that the Medrash goes on to note that tzaddikim also hold back, like the mountains, tzidkascha kahareel, that tzaddikim hold back the flooding of the world from the great depths. And the imagery seems to be that the depths want to take over the world because the world is full of sin. But there's also the possibility of tshuva, and that's what the mountains represent. The mountains represent HaKadosh Baruch Hu's patience in holding back this drowning of the world through the depths taking over. And that's why the pasuk in the Nevuah of Yeshaya, the pasuk says that in the future, the time will come that all the mountains will be flattened out. So what's the significance of the mountains be flattened out? Is that what we wait for when it comes to Mashiach? That we should have flat mountains, we should have non-mountains? So the imagery seems to be that loss of level, there won't be a tzahara, there won't be a desire to sin, so we won't have a need for these mountains in order to counteract that. But at the same time, the imagery of Yerushalayim, Harim Savivla, that the idea is that here Yerushalayim is God's palace, so to speak, so God's palace should be surrounded by protection. So the mountains represent the protection against the Yetzirah and the constant Shmira, the constant vigilance. And that's what their message is. And that's also what the Pasuk says in Parshas Balak, that Bilam comments, Mirosh Tzurim Erenu, that I can stand on the top of the mountain and I can see what's going on. That his message is to Balak, that Balak thinks, why don't you go curse the Jews and you can find what to work with, because the Jews have sinned, they sinned with the Egel Hazav, you can capitalize on that. And Bilam explains to him that it's not really how it works, that they have the ability to do tshuva, and that the mountains represent the tshuva, and that's going to undermine any desire to curse them. And that's also the message of the Nevuah of Yeshayahu, when he says, Manavu al Haharim, what the beautiful message of the mountains. The beautiful message of the mountains is the ability to do tshuva, is the ability to change. So here we find that the world had been blind to this message, the world had ignored the patience of God and the ability to do tshuva, and therefore the symbolism is that now even the mountains are covered up, even this last hope of what you could look to is obscured by the water. And presumably the whole notion of saying that the mountains have this representation of God's patience, but also specifically of the ability to do tshuva, so presumably it comes in two ways. That one is the mountains represent something high you can look up to, represent a value system that you can see from afar, and that you can remain focused and that you can point to. But they also represent protection. They also represent the fact that a person who wants to be successful, he has to minimize the temptations, he has to do whatever he can to make sure that he has protection around him. I was just reading about the contemporary studies involving willpower and the notion that willpower is like a muscle that, on the one hand, you can strengthen through exercise, but on the other hand, also eventually fatigues if you put too much stress on it, so then it can't continue to function. So one, if he wants to be successful against temptation, so he can't always rely on his willpower, he can't expect to have infinite ability to hold out, he has to do what he can to try to avoid those temptations and try to create this protection. So presumably the mountains have this double imagery, that they are a value system that you can look to and remain inspired and focused, and also something that serves as protection. And that's what you also find, the notion that we have that when someone gets married, the notion of fasting before a wedding, and the idea that some of the Mefarshim have, the Magen Avraham quotes from earlier sources, and the Beis Shmuel quotes from earlier sources, the Maharam Mintz and others, that the idea is because a chassan gets a kapara for his averos. So there's different theories as to why a chassan gets kapara for his averos. So some point to a Gemara Nivamas that says that somebody who gets married basically sets up a system of protection for himself in terms of arayus and things like that. And so the idea that somebody is investing in this kind of protection, so to speak, that itself is a kapara, and presumably that's along the lines of this imagery that by looking towards the protection of the mountains, that itself is an act of tshuva, is an act of shmira, and that's this imagery that mountains represent, and that's what the pasuk is perhaps emphasizing here, that they missed that, that the mountains have now been covered up. So basically what's happened is that everyone is dead, everyone is gone. That's what the psukim go on to say. Vayigva kol basar haromeis al ha'aretz ba'ufa v'behemo v'chayiv v'chol sheretz ha'shoretz al ha'aretz v'chol ha'adam. And then this next pasuk is very significant in terms of practical halacha, the source of great debate. The pasuk goes on to say, "Kol asher nishmas ruach chayim ba'apav, mikol asher b'charava meisum." That anyone, anything that had the breath of life in his nose, so anything that was on the land, it all died. So the Gemara Maseches Yuma comments on this pasuk, "Ruach chayim ba'apav." Then melamed sheikir chiyusa ba'apeh. That the main life, so to speak, is in the nose, meaning it's in the breathing. And this has important, just on the surface, important halacha l'maaseh ramifications. The Gemara has this Maseches Yuma over there in the last parak to tell us that if you have somebody who's trapped under a collapsed building, and the question is, are they still alive, so that we should be mechal Shabbos in order to save their life, so we keep digging them out until we're sure that they're no longer alive. So the Gemara says you check by checking the breathing, checking the nose to see if they're still breathing. So that's the major nafkamina of this that the Gemara brings. The Gemara Maseches Sota has another nafkamina which is a little bit less relevant to us in such a dramatic way. The Gemara talks about if you have an egla rufa and you have to measure between, it's between two cities, and you have to measure which city is closest, so you measure from the nose because that's where the life is. So that's, again, a little bit less likely to have such an impact. But the other Gemara is very relevant and is, of course, at the center of the contemporary brain death debate. The whole question of what the definition of death is today, one of the most significant controversies in halacha, which you're not going to take a stand on now, but one of the main chakiros really goes around this question, around this pasuk. That if the Gemara says that you check the breathing to see if there's life, so does that mean that breath is life, like this Gemara a little bit sounds, she'ikir chiyusa ba'apeh? Or do we say that, no, that breathing is the sign of life, but that it's not the definition of life? And that, of course, has huge ramifications. So if a person is brain dead, if a person's brain is no longer controlling his breathing, the breathing comes from an external respirator. So then there are those who maintain that that is death, and there are others who maintain that no, breathing is not the definition of life. It's especially in the time of Chazal, when it wasn't really shaykh to bifurcate things, that was how you checked for life. But life is not defined by breathing. Life is defined by other functioning, by the heart beating and the like. So this is a major, major practical machlokas with humongous, humongous ramifications, among the most consequential ramifications of any machlokas going on today. So a lot of it, it all travels around a handful of makaros, which could be read in either direction. And that's why many poskim also maintain that we can't really be machria, and that essentially it's a suffix because we're not really sure what the reading of these makaros are, but there's really just a handful of a small set of sources that are invoked in the discussion, and this is very high on the list. This is Gemara that says that we check the breathing in order to sense for life because of what this pasuk says, Kol asher nishmas ruach chayim ba'apav. The idea of the nose, the Torah Tamima suggests, and it's pointed out, and my grandfather, a commentator on Torah Tamima, points out that these ideas are also in the Pirkei Rabbi Elazar. That, first of all, perhaps the idea of life exiting through the nose, so to speak, is because it also came in through the nose, v'yipach ba'apav nishmas chayim, and also the notion of that the Gemara has, that before Yaakov's time, people would die, they would sneeze and they would die. That the life would basically exit directly through the nose. And then things changed when there was a more nuanced process of illness and the like. So that also centers around the nose. And also the Gemara says we have a practice which is now shared by all cultures in the world, that if somebody sneezes, so we wish them good health. The Gemara says, Asusa, and again, that Labriut, Gesundheit, God bless you, however the version has taken hold, but it's an idea that we find in Chazal, the idea of expressing wishes for good health when somebody sneezes. And the notion all seems to go back to this idea that the nose was the source of breathing, the source of life, and that life could exit that way. It's an interesting discussion in Poskim about whether this should be done during learning. Is this considered to be Bittul Torah to say Asusa or not? Or do we say that nowadays, Halavai, we should be on such a Madrega that that's really an interruption? So that happens to be a discussion that Shach Nataz and Poskim talk about this, but it all seems to revolve around this issue of the nose. But again, even more significantly, the idea that breathing is the definition of life, and the question of whether it's a siddin or a siba all ties into this pasuk. Hi.
So in regards to, I don't know if it's very technical in terms of neshama versus nefesh, but the pasuk says nishmas rachayim, but there the pasuk is talking about animals, no?
Right.
So isn't that, I thought we said that people have a neshama as opposed to just a nefesh.
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion. If you look in the sefer, I didn't want to get into this, but if you look, there's a sefer called Yad HaMelech, it's written by one of the sons of the Nadav Yehuda. So he gets into the Rambam's philosophy about the difference between nefesh and neshama and what this pasuk.
Right?
It's a little bit of a question, but if you want to take a look at it, you want to see a discussion about it. So they recently came out with a collection of the Nodav Yehuda's writings on Chumash. He didn't write directly on Chumash. He wrote Tshuvas and he wrote Drashas and many other things, but they collected his writings and organized it alpi Seder HaPsukim. So if you look at that, say for the manufactured Chidusha Hinoda Bihuda Ala Torah. So look on this pasuk, he talks a little bit about the terminology and about what exactly is the meaning of the word neshama, the meaning of the word nefesh. But it's true that we normally assume that animals don't have souls, don't have a neshama in that sense, and that here it means it in the sense of nishima, in the sense of breathing, but, that which is an expression of breath. That's what's relevant here. That's a good segue to the next point I want to talk about. So this whole idea that the animals pay the price here, together with people. So there's a lot of indications about that throughout this parsha, but that's what these next psukim emphasize, the focus on the animals and all of creation. So this big emphasis on the fact that the animals are taken out as well, and it prompts the Gemara to raise the issue, and the Mefarshim raise the issue, that the animals presumably didn't sin. The animals don't have Bechira Chafshis, really. So why should they be taken out at the same time? That's a question that's also asked in the Mefarshim, ask about the Ketanim. It certainly sounds like from the Rambam that even by Mishpat Bnei Noach, which is a different standard than by the Mishpat of Sanhedrin, still Ketanim are not subject to an onesh, and certainly very young Ketanim. You could maybe argue about what the definition of godless is in the Ben Noach system, but certainly very young children shouldn't be subject to punishment. So the Mefarshim talk about this a little bit, have different approaches as to what the answer is. Most of them are not very satisfying in terms of the Ketanim. And presumably, the real approach is that the punishment was on all of society at once. It wasn't on an individual basis. At this point, it's not that every individual was looked at and said, you're guilty, but this is beget to the fact that the whole world was judged guilty, and therefore everything included in the world. And it seems to evoke a little bit, which there's some who connect this to this, but it's a little bit of a different idea that we find by Korach. So the Magaif from the time of Korach, so children died also, and Chazal have a comment that you see Kasha Onshin Shel Machlokas, that even the Ketanim get punished for it. Now you see Machlokas is such a terrible Aveira that even the children pay the price. So it sounds like it's a collective punishment, but presumably the intent of that, and that's why it's a little bit different than what's going on here, but maybe it's similar, is that the intent of that statement is not to say that, oh, machlokas is such a terrible aveira that we lower the threshold of punishment. You know, we try you as an adult because the crime is so serious. I don't think that's what it means. I think what it means is that machlokas is so destructive that the impact is so far-ranging that even the children, we know this from real life, right? That when families are fighting, the children get caught up in it, even though the children don't do anything. And the Torah is making the point that machlokas has this impact that is going to transcend even the ones who are actually the perpetrators. So that's not exactly what's going on here. The focus isn't so much on machlokas, but presumably there is a similar idea that the nature of the corruption is such that it was pervasive, and it was pervasive in the whole world. And it's a chaval that people who are not really responsible, people who are not really bnei das, whether they are young human beings or incapacitated human beings or animals, whatever it is, should be included in this. But that's a part of the idea. And you find that there's a little bit of a stira here that says when the Gemara Maseches Sanhedrin, which Sanhedrin Kuf Ches Amud Aleph, which has the lashon of Behema Machata, what the animals do wrong. So we do find elsewhere in Chazal that the animals did do wrong activities, that they engaged in sexual behavior that was perverse for the animals as well. So there is somewhat of a tension between those makoros. So the Forshim suggest, again, that still the animals don't really have control of what they're doing. They're doing it because the human beings are impacting on them, either directly or indirectly. And that's, again, this extensive impact of chet, which I'll take a question in a second. We see it's also interesting because the discussion that Chazal have an emphasis here, and when the pasuk says Asher b'charava, that which was on the land, so to speak, so the Gemara says Maseches Vachem, this shows you that shel nigra gezeira al hadagim, that the fish were not subject to the gezeira of being wiped out. So the Radak says, yeah, well, fish live in water, so they're not going to be a problem. It's not going to be a problem for them to have a flood because they can survive a flood. It's no different than their normal life. So that's not so compelling as the Torah Tamina points out. Another point out that if God wanted to destroy the fish, he could have destroyed the fish. And the language of the Gemara doesn't sound that way because it says, lo nigruz or gezeira, that they were exempted actively from this gezeira. And the Gemara also tells us that the water wasn't normal water, it was boiling hot water, so presumably it could have fried the fish at the same time. So to say that the fish were saved because of the reality of their water-loving nature is hard to believe that's the case. So the suggestion, Torah Tamim discusses this, and others discuss this also, that the fish seemed to be separate from the averus of the animals, that they did not have this issue of interspecies relations that seem to have struck all the other animals. This is the Tosfos in Bava Kama says that's true about fish. Fish do not have that problem, that they get involved with other species. And here it seems to be, again, it's not that all the animals don't really have bechira in terms of what they're going to do and what they're not going to do, but they are impacted by their interaction with the human beings. And the fish, being in a whole different world, being in the realm of the deep, are protected from their interaction with human beings. So that's a little bit the imagery here, that the message seems to be that the corruption is so pervasive that it transcends the actual willing perpetrators and has an impact on everyone within their orbit. And you know, kind of emphasize that point by teaching us that there are creatures that are not in the orbit, such as the fish, and the fish were saved from this fate. So Amir, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so does Chazal comment on the pairs of animals that were brought in? Why not all animals?
Right, so apparently they were exempted for the purposes of humanity. Yeah, they needed to... for the purposes... Well, I didn't mean it the way I said it, but it's also true that the Gemara asks about the animals, what did they sin? So then the Gemara actually goes on to answer that animals are created to serve humanity, and if humanity is corrupt, they also become corrupt. So in that sense, it's for humanity. But what I also meant was for posterity, that the animals needed to survive, that their species should survive. So we need at least a token animal. It's interesting to wonder if these animals were selected or somehow were holier than the other animals, and if it should really parallel humanity, that the people who were selected to survive were the most worthy of the people. So is there some idea that somehow these individual animals were worthier? I don't know, but there needed to be something to be saved in order for the animals to continue, so it seems like that was a lucky exemption that they got. So there is a lot of discussion about this here and elsewhere, about the whole impact that the corruption of humanity had, not just on the people, but on the children, on the animals, and the like, and how everything comes along with that. So then there is a fascinating drasha that at the end of this pasuk, so the pasuk says that after everything else was destroyed, Vayishor ach Noach v'asher ito bateva, that all that was left was Noach. So there is a drasha you might be familiar with, Chazal quote, Rishonim quote, that Ach Noach, Noach is alone. And Rashi quotes this idea that seems to imply there's something missing. We'll discuss in a second where this drasha comes from. But that Noach apparently was not 100% shalom at that point, but that he had had a run-in with a lion, that once he was late in bringing the food to a lion, and the lion attacked him, so now he was limping, now he was injured, and that's somehow derived from this pasuk of Yishar Ach Noach. So there's a lot of discussion about this, as you can imagine. First of all, the whole connotation seems to be that it's kind of a punishment, that because he was late in serving this lion, so he ends up being attacked in this way. And it's a little bit of a difficult idea to understand, because here this entire time he's waiting hand and foot on all the animals, and he can't even sleep. That's what the Medrash says. He doesn't sleep at any point because he was taking care of the animals 24/7, and now he's late for 1 minute, so he ends up with such a wound, with such an injury. So Rav Eliashiv has a comment that this is to tell us that when you have a mabul going on, when you have a moment of crisis, so the best you can do is not enough. The fact that he was providing such wonderful service, which any other normal time would be something you'd say, okay, he's doing a great job, how could you complain if he's late 1 minute? But in a situation of crisis, in a situation of great need, everyone is expected to really go above and beyond, and perhaps that's the Mr. Haskell there a little bit. But there is a fascinating... Hi?
Could that be connected also to Rashi's commentary at the beginning, which is makes a distinction between Abraham and Noah, and essentially Noah was an insular individual, and even though he was like a tzaddik, he didn't push himself to extend to others, and this is a representation of that, in the sense that he could have maybe gone to the line, or he could have taken action, but it says he was alone, he maybe isolated himself in a certain way. Do you think there's a parallel there?
There's very much a parallel. We'll get to that right now, and even more so in a second. That there is, it's very much expanded that. Do you want to comment along those lines?
I'm on the point before. Where is Rabbi Yashav Paras and Chumash?
Yeah. Divrei Agada. Sefer called Divrei Agada. They actually came out more recently with another sefer from him on Haaretz on Chumash, more halachically oriented. But when he was alive, I think they published a sefer called Divrei Agada. But in any event, so this notion along the lines of what you're saying, there's a fascinating essay about this, and again in the sefer Shvilei Pinchas we mentioned a few minutes ago, with Pinchas Friedman, where he notes as follows. He says that clearly there is this message that the lion's attack is some type of a punishment to Noah. And he suggests, along the lines of what you're saying, that it's a punishment for his behavior before the Teva, that not because he was late that day, but that we know that Noach gets a very bad rap in general in Chazal. It's really very striking, because I don't know where else you find such a dichotomy between the way the Chumash presents things and the way Chazal read it, that here the Chumash really seems to praise Noach tremendously. In the past 2 years, we spoke about this more, because this comes up in the first and second Aliyahs a lot, but it's the pervasive theme throughout Parshas Noach, that the Torah calls Noach a tzaddik, a tamim, many times. And every time it says something, Chazal say, well, he wasn't so great, this, he was only great in comparison, he didn't deserve to be saved, but matzachein, Pasuk in the end of Bereishis that says that Noach matzachein, so that Chazal say shows you he didn't really deserve in his own merit to be saved. So there's this constant tension, and we know that the notion that's expressed in the Zohar and expressed in other sources, that Noach was really not on such a madrega personally compared to people who would come later, such as Avram and Moshe. And Avram actually overlapped in his lifetime with Noach. That everything goes to a step further, that when Avram hears that stone is going to be destroyed, so Avram prays on their behalf. He doesn't just say he's happy to be spared the destruction. And when Moshe is told the Jews are going to be destroyed after the Chet HaEgel, not only does he pray on their behalf, he says, "Mecheni na misifrecha, if you're not going to save them, take me out of the equation also." So the notion seems to be that there is a progression in terms of tzidkus going from Noach to Avram to Moshe, and then Noach really pales in comparison. I think the Arizal comments are interesting, that Mecheni na, if you move the letters around, it spells Mei Noach. And Mei Noach in the Haftorah for Parshas Noach, Chazal note on that phrase that the water, the Mabul, is called Mei Noach, the waters of Noach, and you think that's an inappropriate name. We should really call it the waters of everybody but Noach, because Noach was the one person who didn't deserve to be destroyed. So that's where some of the Mefarshim point out that you see that apparently there is an idea that Noach was responsible for everybody in that generation, because he didn't take a full activity. You find different versions, whether he didn't daven for them enough, or that he didn't try to impact on their behavior, phrased in different ways. But in some sense of the word, or in a couple of senses of the word, he was not sufficiently involved in impacting everybody else. And therefore, he was saved, and only on a relative basis was his merit significant. So the notion, as Rav Pinchas Friedman discusses it, is that the lion represents everything Moshe wasn't. You know, the lion is the king of the beasts, and he has two qualities that Moshe lacked. One is that the lion has a loud voice, so the lion can impact on others, can be mochiach others, and clearly Noach did not have, figuratively speaking, a loud voice. And also the lion takes a leadership role and worries about everybody in his family, so to speak, and that was what Noach didn't do. So the lion represents all the failings of Noach and comes to punish him. So that's already an interesting idea, which there are other indications of. But then he goes on to discuss, he says, so where did Chazal get the drasha from? Where do you see in this pasuk that anything like that happened? So he suggests this idea of Vayishar Ach Noach, that only Noach was left. So it's a very interesting point. So that if we say that Ela told us Noach, that Noach was only tzaddik haya b'dorosav, that he was only a tzaddik by comparison to his generation, so now he's in trouble, because there's no one else left. And so when he was the best person in the world, okay, so then he was a tzaddik by comparison. But we see from Chazal's attitude to him, that he didn't seem to be an objective tzaddik, he only seemed to be a relative tzaddik. So when there's nobody else left, and that's what this whole pasuk is about, Vayimach is kol Yaakov, everything else has been wiped out, only Noach is left alive. So first of all, that itself represents his failings, that represents the fact that everyone else was destroyed because he wasn't on top of the situation to save them. And also it puts him in a bad light, because now he doesn't have the relative merit of being better than everyone else. So now that needs the tikkun, that needs to be repaired if he's going to be able to survive to the next stage. He needs to be not only relatively good, he needs to be objectively good. And that's where the lion essentially gives a muster. The lion says, I'm better than you, I'm going to attack you, because you have to learn the midos of being like a lion, of being a leader with a loud voice. A fascinating idea. There's a whole essay about this, but that's both the imagery involved, and also perhaps how Chazal saw it in the pasuk. quite a fascinating idea. So all of this really kind of segues also into the next pasuk, the next parak, which is also part of this aliyah. So the pasuk, the next in between the pasuk, v'yiruhamayim al-aretz chamishim ha'asyom, but then parak ches begins and it says vayizkor elokim es Noach, that God remembered Noach. So what does it mean that He remembered Noach? So the Aruch Chaim has a comment here. He remembers all the chesed that He did in the Teva. And there is a medrash, a very powerful comment the medrash has, and the Rashiv Karbiavner of Volvich Zechitat of Racha has a very important essay about this in a Sefer Asufas Ma'arachos, about the whole nature of the Teva, which really reads into this pasuk. That there's a medrash, for example, it's an idea that you find throughout, there's a medrash that says that Shem was met by Avram, and Avram asked him, Alkitzadek, Avram asked him, what schus did you have to leave the teva? And he says that the chesed that we did all day long, day and night, 24/7, we had to take care of all the animals. And then in that context, he also brings up a story. And in fact, it once happened that my father was late to take care of the lion attacked him. So the whole phrasing is interesting because you might say the schus that's relevant is that they were saved from the flood to go into the teva. The whole phrasing of what schus did you have to go out of the teva is itself interesting. And then the Medrash goes on to say that Avraham Avinu was so mushkel by this, he says, wow, you see that the tremendous schus that comes, the tremendous protection that comes from taking care of animals, imagine if I would take care of people, it would be even better. And he then went on to his illustrious career as a Baal Chesed, taking care of human beings. So the notion seems to be that Noah had a failing in terms of not being actively involved in the needs of others. And he was lucky to be saved, you know, lucky in the sense of Matzachein, that he seemed to transcend what he actually deserved. But that's not enough to get to stage two. That's not enough that the rest of humanity is going to be called Menei Noah. They're going to come from him, that he's going to rebuild the world after the destruction. He's not ready for that yet. He's only ready for that after a year of intensive work where he's creating this Midas HaChesed, where he is honing this ability to take care of everything else and of everybody and of everybody else. It's only because of that that he could then leave the Teva and start stage two and become the progenitor of all the rest of humanity. So that's a key phase, and so therefore the Rashid discussed that the Teva was the base medrash of Chesed. It was his opportunity to train and to learn these qualities of Chesed. And we know, it's always pointed out, that Chesed is cultivated by expressing Chesed towards others. The more you practice it, the more you cultivate that Midah. That's one of the key notions that we have as descendants of Avraham Avinu. We were told, V'halachta b'drachav, that we should follow in God's path, meaning that we have to cultivate his midah of rachamim and chesed through acting in ways of chesed, through engaging in chesed. So before we can get to Avram's activities, we first have Noach, Noach acting in this way in the teva, and that's what gives him the ability to get out, and that's what this medrash is getting in. So this notion of vayizkor elokim es Noach, then remember the chesed, that's perhaps what's being suggested here. And there is, along those lines, a suggestion that the Psalm Derech has, Simchas Yisrael Broid, Rashiv of Chevron, in his Sefer on Chumash. So he asks, why did Noach then send out the birds? The whole thing with the raven and the dove, which is also in this Aliyah. Why did he do that? It's not like he needed to do that in order to know when to get out of the teva. It's clear that he only was going to leave the teva when God told him to leave the teva, as is indeed the case. So why did he have to send out all these messengers in order to find out what's going on? So he mentions a few approaches there. He suggests that maybe Noach was very eager to bring the karbanos, so he was scoping out the situation about the karbanos. Others suggest that since the Mabul represented this time of Charon Af, this time of tremendous anger, so he wanted to know if that had subsided. He wanted to know if things had changed. So he wanted to get a sense of the temperature outside. But he himself prefers the interpretation the Sam Darach, that the idea is that here Noach was not only worried about leaving the Teva, he's worried about taking care of all of his animals. So therefore he wants to know what's the environment outside, so he can start thinking about when the animals are going to come out and how exactly to deal with it. And at this point it's an emotional connection. He's developed this midah of chesed, so now he's not just worried about what his instructions are, but he's also plugged into the needs of taking care of the animals. And therefore, that becomes kind of an intuitive issue that he wants to find out about. So, of course, it's an interesting discussion, why specifically these animals and why specifically these birds. Presumably, birds make the most sense because of their whole flying ability, but there are other kinds of birds as well. So there is an interesting discussion about this in the Sefer Oznayim LaTorah. Rav Zalman Sirotzkin has a discussion about why specifically a raven and a dove, and he suggests as follows. He suggests that this is also a part of Noach's overall sensitivity, that if he's going to send out these animals, so it's a little bit of a dangerous mission, that's what the raven complains, is how do you know I'm going to come back, and how do you know you're going to have a continued existence? Maybe you should send one of the kosher animals, there's more of that, and they're going to just send me, and if I don't come back, my species is not going to survive. Of course, Noach knew that that's how he could guarantee that he would survive, because he had to continue the species. But why specifically these two birds? So the suggestion he has there is that since he's going to send out a bird, and he doesn't want to send out both the birds together, the two couple of the birds, because ain't someone on lace, why send out two when you can send out one? So they're going to send out one, it means he has to separate a couple. He has to take a husband and wife and separate them. So out of all the different birds, we find expressions in Chazal that ravens and doves are unique in terms of how they relate to their spouses. Ravens in a bad way, and the bird and the doves in a good way. Now, the ravens, Chazal, have an idea that they don't like their children, and they don't like their wife, because the children, when they're young, they come out a different color. The raven is black, and the birds are white when they're young, and therefore they don't feel connected to them, and they think that the wife cheated on them. So the bird hates his kids, he hates his wife, he doesn't have much of a shaychus to his spouse. So therefore, Noah thought that in terms of expressing sensitivity to the animals, the least suffering of separation would be imposed if he would send out the raven. That would have the least impact on a happy bird family. But then when the raven didn't really want to go, so then the other choice coming from the other direction is the Yonah, because Chazal tell us that the Yonah has a special quality, that they're faithful to each other, and even after one dies, they don't get into a relationship with another bird. So therefore, at least it could guarantee that there wouldn't be any problems from that angle, from sending out the Yonah. So then when the raven wouldn't go, the Yonah became the best choice. So that's how he suggests how he chose these specific birds for this mission. Of course, we know, and we'll end on this note, that we also find that Yonah has an imagery that it's connected to the Jews. The Jews are compared to a dove, compared to a Yonah. And here, the pasuk that talks about the Yonah, we're very familiar with. It's a very famous pasuk, and it's adapted in the Shabbos Miros. So some, first of all, note, in the Das Kenyan Bali Atosus, he writes that there is an imagery here that the Yonah was sent out on Shavasa Batamas, and therefore represents the beginning of the Galus, represents the Jews being sent into Galus, the process beginning on Shavasa Batamas, and not finding rest, not finding a Manoach in Galus. But also at the same time, others point out that it's necessary that the Yonah doesn't find Manoach, because in exile, and the Pasuk in Eicha makes reference to this phrase as well, about Manoach, not about the Yonah, that when the Jewish people are in exile, so it's important that they don't get too comfortable. It's important that they don't have Manoach, that they don't feel rest in the context of the nations of the world, in the context of Galus, because they'll lose their connection to their Misara, they'll lose their recognition of their special origins, and they'll also take on the values of the outside society, which is not necessarily the values that they're meant to live by. So Chazal have a comment on that pasuk in Eicha, that if the Jews did find Manoach, they would have to be brought right out. That would be particularly problematic. And that it's the protection of the Jews that they don't find Manoach in these environments. And there is a famous comment that Meshech Chachma has. He was writing in the latest in the 20s, where he wrote that the Jews who think that Berlin has become Yerushalayim are going to find that's very problematic. They're going to find that that's going to have a terrible impact. That's one of the most forceful statements of the idea that you can't confuse Berlin for Yerushalayim, you can't confuse Galus for home. And that's often connected to this imagery that the Yonah doesn't find Manoach l'chaf ragla. And this really ties into what we began with, talking about the mountains. And here we find ourselves in a situation of Galus, and particularly we here at the YU, so we have chosen to partake of many of the blessings of the outside culture and to study the lessons and the messages of the broader culture in a university setting. And we feel that there's a lot to gain from that, but only to gain from that with a recognition that we need the mountains, we need the protection, and we need to not be totally at rest in that setting without the vigilance that's required of the mountains that we mentioned at the outset, which again involves a two-part message, a message that we have to create protections for ourselves, that we have to create mountains around us to make sure that we're always at an appropriate distance from that which may not necessarily be wholly beneficial, and also that the mountains represent the high values that we look at, that we look to for guidance, to make sure that we're always connected to that original source and that we should never feel too comfortable being too far away. Right, so we'll end with that. Wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos, and again, God willing, next week we should be back normal. Hopefully we should be around more, and everything should be good.